The Confluence Media Collective is honored to have with us tonight one of the nation's most well-known and controversial public intellectuals, former Professor Ward Churchill. One of the nation's best-known public intellectuals, he's the author of 14 books and over 150 articles. After a career spanning almost three decades, Professor Churchill was terminated from the University of Colorado when he garnered national attention for an essay published 3 years earlier in which he compared some of the victims of September 11th to Nazi bureaucrat Adolf Eichmann. Despite winning his suit for reinstatement before a jury, which rejected the University of Colorado's contention that he was fired for academic misconduct, the judge in the case set aside the jury's verdict and upheld the university's decision to terminate him. His case is currently on appeal. Unlike other academics, Ward Churchill is an activist who has been and continues to be involved in the struggle for social justice here and around the world. It is a decision for which he has paid a heavy price. He has been attacked for his support for the struggle of indigenous people in Nicaragua, attacked for asserting there may be times when repression becomes so brutal that the individual has no choice but to take up arms against the state. Finally, he's been attacked for his ancestry, for not being native enough to have devoted much of his life to supporting the struggles of indigenous people for sovereignty, dignity, and self-determination. Professor Churchill's work has given voice to the marginalized and disenfranchised in our society. He has had the courage to speak truth to power, regardless of the cost. We oppose the forces in this society that would silence him and, by extension, us. It's my great pleasure to introduce to you tonight Professor Ward Churchill.
Thank you, Pete. Sio, Mosiju. Hello, my relatives. It's really good to see you here, all of you. Beginning to wonder. I can put a question to the crowd. It comes from Hunter Thompson, actually. Used to live up in Woody Creek before his death. Has it ever gotten weird enough for you? Hasn't managed to do that for me yet, but it keeps working on it. I think you have a little taste of why that is over the past week here in Grand Junction. But I need to bring you some greetings. I need to say some thank yous. And greetings from Colorado Chapter of the American Indian Movement. We're in Colorado, but we've never had a presence over in Grand Junction. So far as I know, it's the first time there's been an AIM presence here since the Longest Walk. And that was passing through. I bring you greetings from Gwarthy Las, otherwise known as Leonard Peltier, who, as I speak to you today, continues to sit in a cage at a federal prison, Lewisburg, Pennsylvania, not for anything that anyone, including even his prosecutor, has been prepared to go on record as saying they know he actually did, at least not at any point in the last 25, well, I'm getting older, 30 years. He sits in that cage as a symbol of the arbitrary ability of the federal government of the United States to repress the legitimate aspirations to liberation of indigenous people within its claimed boundaries, no more, no less. He's a message. The cost and consequence that will be inflicted on those who stand for their rights in this land of the free, home of the brave. But some thank yous are in order. In the nature of the thank yous, in a way, shapes what it is that I'll have to say. Because I'm no longer saying what I originally thought I would say. Circumstances tend to dictate. But thank you first and foremost to Confluence Media Collective for deciding to have this event and for sticking with it when the world started to get weird. You may want to take into account that if it's not getting weird on you, you're doing something wrong. If you're not getting blowback, you're doing something wrong. Nobody's paying any attention. Lesson learned, yes? Maybe some of you already knew it. Thank you to the Unitarian Universalists, whatever. They are why we are having this event on this particular day. The invitation was extended, open-ended. I happen to be en route to San Francisco for an event. That makes it rather convenient. Grand Junction, geographically, is between the two points. So I had actually said, since I have to present in San Francisco on Friday, appoint later in a week. Unitarians were putting up the space to hold the event in and said this would be a better date. And so it was scheduled for Memorial Day. I didn't even know it was a Memorial Day. I don't know whether the organizers did either. I wasn't paying that much attention. But the fact of Memorial Day being the day of the event wasn't some nefarious conspiratorial plot to defame the, well, we'll get to that. Okay? It was bureaucratic consideration of the universal Unitarian blah blah. Okay? Who then promptly rescinded the invitation, so the whole reason for having the thing on this date was nullified by their rather peculiar sense of unity. An even more peculiar sense of universality. Yeah. I think we ought to take credit for something before we go forward, too. That is for having finally prompted the Tea Party to do what I would have assumed that they were doing as a matter of course, which is holding an event to commemorate the honored dead. But they, for whatever reason, seemed not to have been doing that until they needed to do it as a political statement and counter to me, and by extension to you. So let's take credit for getting those patriots to act patriotic on this particular date. It's the first time that's ever happened. Since it is Memorial Day, and since that became the crux of a non-issue, why a veteran of America's foreign imperial adventures would be anathema to speak on a date having to do with the honoring of people who have fallen in pursuit of America's foreign imperial adventures is a little mysterious to me, especially when it's coming from people who have never donned a uniform in their life, for the most part. What's Memorial Day about? And probably everybody here has a notion. Think you know what it's about, and some of you might actually even know. But it's not what's been put out in what I've read, attending the discontent with this event occurring on this day, beginning with the Unitarian statement that some of their congregants had relatives and close friends currently serving in Iraq and Afghanistan. If you're currently serving, you're probably alive. And it's not about those who are alive. It's about those who fell in America's wars. A little bit of a contradiction in terms there. Generally wide of what the day is supposed to be about, which is commemoration of those who died. But when we say those who died, who does that mean? Yeah, I know. I see the picture in the paper today of the tombstones at the cemetery. Those who wore the uniform of the United States, where they're buried, and the little flags being put there. And that's undoubtedly a piece of it, but only a piece. It's kind of like Christmas. You know, the whole point of the designated date seems to have gotten lost in the shuffle here. So let's go back a little bit. It has a history. It has a beginning. And that beginning comes at the end of what they teach you in high school was the Civil War. You go to other parts of the country, it's called something else. I spent a fair amount of time in Georgia. Down there, they call it the War of Southern Succession. And if they're hardliners, they call it the War of Yankee Aggression. Although most of the people talking about Yankee aggression got American flag stickers on the back bumpers of their cars, so, hey, go figure. But that's where Memorial Day begins, in the aftermath of that war between the states, so-called. Commemorate the dead, those who had fallen, 600,000 plus on both sides. And the way that's cast is that they were all Americans. Well, they were all inhabitants of North America. But that right there, as an historical revision of the First Order. Confederate States of America was a separate country. It proclaimed itself as such, just as the United States, it proclaimed itself a country separate from the British Empire. This was British territory. Well, not this that we're standing on. But what becomes the United States was part of Great Britain. It proclaimed itself separate. And in 1861, the Confederate States proclaimed themselves to be a country separate from the United States. They had their constitution. They had their executive branch. They had their judiciary. They had their legislature. They had their currency. They had their foreign policy and foreign relations. They had treaty relations with others. They had trade relations. They had the whole shtick. They were a country. That was another country. In the sense that American implies citizens of the United States, they proclaimed themselves to be other. So in America's war, those commemorated in that first Memorial Day were both sides who had fallen. And post hoc proclaiming them, those who had fallen wearing gray, to have been Americans just like those wearing blue, well, you can attach a certain logic to it, I suppose, by virtue of the fact that U.S. citizenship was reimposed upon the vanquished at that point. But then how do we deal with the American Indians? Who, aren't they Americans too? All of them. But is Memorial Day, while the little flags are being planted on the tombstones of those who wore blue out in this part of the world, really encompassing a commemoration of the Indians who killed them? Well, yeah, maybe we can make that case now because U.S. citizenship has been imposed upon those of those other countries with whom the United States had treaties and had recognized that they were separate countries. Maybe so now. Maybe so 100 years after the conflict ended and after institutions like the Teller School here in Grand Junction had fulfilled the mission of killing the Indian, saving the man, and every pupil forcibly conscripted to go and be indoctrinated to see themselves through the lens of their conquerors, their oppressors, their subjugators. Maybe in that sense, Memorial Day could be taken, should be taken, to encompass those who fell on both sides of the so-called Indian Wars, which I think if you check the record, were never started by Indians. I've looked and I've looked and I've looked, and I've never found any record of the flotilla of birch bark canoes that traversed the Atlantic and invaded England or France. Peaceful settlers who would be the invaders of somebody else's country, appropriating their homelands, their property, their economy, their culture, to convert them into something acceptable to those who were doing the taking. Well, that has kind of run its course. But now we're dealing with those who fell on both sides. And if we're going to be consistent with the original framing of Memorial Day, would we not then have to pay some credence when we, for example, go to pay our respects to the names on the black marble wall in Washington, D.C., inscribed with 58,000 members of my generation and the army of which I was a part? The military, I guess you'd have to say, because there are Marines, there's naval personnel, there's airmen, there's even a couple women. They didn't let women into the combat zone that much. But some died in uniform in Southeast Asia. Well, certainly it would encompass them, but now how about the 4 to 5 million Indochinese that fell on the other side? Is there a thought given to them? Do we even acknowledge the Holocaustal impact of not going to extend assistance to another people's suffering invasion, to free them from the prospect of tyranny, but to prevent people from opting to a government which is not approved by that of the United States. And who were the invaders? The Vietnamese invaded themselves. North Vietnam, South Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia. It goes on. No, that's not part of the equation. Why? That was the first principle of what was to be commemorated. The monumental human cost consequence, universally speaking, the unity of humanity in acknowledging what these kind of processes and procedures entail. Much more for them than for us. And I've got friends' names on the wall. Still much more for them than for us. When we look at the tombstones of the Korean era veterans, do we take into account another case of people invading itself, apparently? Some line that was drawn by U.S. policymakers in concord with Soviet policymakers in somebody else's country when they tried to reunify. This is not an argument for the North Korean form of government. It's not my place to make an argument for the North Korean form of government, nor is it my place really to make an argument against it. It's for Koreans to decide. But how many Koreans do we acknowledge as being due proper respect and commemoration on Memorial Day? Shall we talk about Hiroshima and Nagasaki? It's talked about. It's not much commemorated on this day. But I'm more concerned, in a way, with those who died under the rain of low-level incendiary bombs unleashed by Curtis LeMay in the fire raids on Tokyo. More people died in Tokyo in one night on the fire raid. Conventional weapons, so-called. Civilians, by and large. One night in Tokyo, 120,000 people or more. And that's only one city. Every major population center in Japan was subjected to the same thing. How many million? This is not an argument for Hirohito's form of government. This is not an argument for Japanese militarism or a defense, a rationalization, a justification for Nanking. This is an acknowledgement of both sides in an American war. Not only the fact that they fell, that they died, that they were consumed, but how they were consumed. Because America, in a sort of maudlin commemoration of itself and its sacrifice, loses willfully all track and sense of how it actually engages in the world. Millions of Japanese, but we could talk about Hamburg. We could talk about Kurt Vonnegut's favorite city. We could talk about the deliberate obliteration of entire cities in Germany. Certainly this is not a defense of Nazism, the Third Reich. What Nazism and the Germans who supported it, which was the preponderance of the population right up to the gates of Moscow, and not a terrible decline in Hitler's popularity until Stalingrad. And you're within a couple of years of the end of the Nazi state before the popularity begins to fall. The general sense and sensibility is that the Germans bore a collective guilt for what it was they embraced and endorsed. And at the 8th Air Force, that saturation bombed the cities and obliterated the civilians. They had an actual, this is Bomber Harris, the RAF commander, not a U.S. officer, but one with whom Hap Arnold and the other Air Force commanders of the United States engaged in closely coordinated activities, doing round-the-clock bombing. Harris's stated objective was to dehouse 1 million German civilian families, to demoralize them. This is the nature of it. But the Germans had it coming because they embraced the conversion of entire other peoples, other populations into hamburger. And if you do that, if that's what you're putting out, when you get it back in kind, you've got no complaint. I think that's an argument that I made with regard to 9/11, actually. When the shoe fits there, I suggest it might fit here. Equal standard, same set of rules, analytically applied, morally applied, and otherwise applied to all. I don't go too far with American exceptionalism. And American exceptionalism, in fact, would be contrary to the original framing of Memorial Day, because, again, it's both sides. Both sides. Go back to the Philippines. I'm sort of jumping over World War I. We could talk about that too. Let's go to the Philippines, because we're liberating a people from Spanish colonialism there, who are called pejoratively Moros. And interestingly enough, Indians, the Indians of the Philippines, that's how they were referred to by Hell Roar and Jake Smith and the other veterans of the Indian Wars that were sent straight across there to liberate these primitive people at the cost of 1.5 million of them. Yeah. Jake issued an order that every male Filipino above the age of 10, found outside approved areas in Luzon, be summarily killed. Turned the most populous area of Luzon into what he himself called a howling wilderness. He liked that word, howling. Yeah. Freedom. Freedom. Stated objective. Weren't very many American fatalities to commemorate in that war. But like I said, 1 million to 1.5 million Filipinos in the process of freeing them from the decrepit Empire of Spain? Maybe so. But then that sort of puts a punctuation point and renders accurate, or at least comprehensible, George Bush's, that's W, not his daddy, observation that problem out there in the world is they hate our freedom. They hate our freedom. I think that's absurd in its face, but when you view freedom in the terms that the Filipinos were taught to understand American notion of freedom, for them, that they be eradicated in place, yeah, might be something to that. They probably did hate it. If that's what freedom means. Well, that's 1902. Begins in 1898, actually. So call it 1900. Kind of round it off in good academic precise fashion. Turn of the century. 1900 is 10 years after 1890, last time I did grade school arithmetic on the chronology. That would make the Philippines 10 years after Wounded Knee. The Battle of Wounded Knee, as the sign said, right up to the American Indian Movement, forced a change of nomenclature to reflect what actually happened there in December of 1890, which was a flat-out massacre. You get people in a hollow basically disarmed and unload on them with Hotchkiss guns, and the bodies are strewn out for 3 miles. We could talk about Wounded Knee, but Wounded Knee is simply one of a whole series. We got that in Colorado. There's this place called Sand Creek, you know. And the patriotic media of the day, Rocky Mountain News proclaiming what was done there to be an unparalleled feat of glory of arms that would live forever, be immortal, the Colorado Volunteers and what they did at Sand Creek. But Sand Creek, again, is just one. You've got a whole series of massacres that stretches out way into the antecedent phase of the United States. The United States doesn't come into being until when shot heard around the world is 1775. That's pretty late in the game. You can trace it all the way back. All the way back, really, to where the Dutch are in possession of what comes to be known as New York after England buys it from Holland. It then is known as New Amsterdam. Holland owns it and can sell it to England by virtue of the fact that they did an interesting little real estate transaction there. They rented some of the property on what's now Manhattan Island from the Raritan. More specifically, a group that's referred to as the Wappinger. I can assure you that wasn't their name for themselves, but thus it's come down in history, the Wappingers. The Wappingers, they really couldn't get with the program. They thought if you rent your property to someone, you still own the property. You can make disposition of it. Dutch weren't having it. We rented it, therefore it's ours. And the resolution to the thing was the Dutch sent a group of military personnel, volunteers, up the island, and they came back with the heads of the Wappingers. Well, they came back with the heads of the Key Wappingers. They didn't bother to carry all those heads back. They basically physically eradicated them, brought back the heads of key leaders, recalcitrants, and so on, to prove that they'd actually done what they said that they did. And then they celebrated with a little game of kickball down by, well, the footings of what becomes known as the World Trade Center. Pretty much in that area, right near Wall Street, which gets its name from the wall of the slave market that existed in New York. You thought that was a southern phenomena? No. All those colonies did that. Yeah, it's where Wall Street gets its name. And that's the location which they built the Trade Center. Oh, yeah. The ball for the kickball game were the heads of the Wappingers. Now, I've heard that I was a liar for hire, and I made all that up because there really wasn't a celebration with the heads of the Wappingers in a community kickball game. The real truth of the matter is it was just some kids out there with that kicking the head around. I exaggerated and fabricated an historical incident. Big difference between a kid sitting there with a crowd around him and the crowd itself. Either way you have it, the story comes out pretty much the same. So that sequence of wars of America, where do we end when we're commemorating? Do we go back to 1775 and take into account all the Indians on the other side when the Indians were other countries and being recognized as such by treaties and all the rest of that? Do we stop at 1775? Or do we acknowledge what was acknowledged at the time, that without the colonial antecedents, the United States would not have come into being? There would be no United States. And so trace that all the way back to the Dutch, to the English proclaiming scalp bounties, to the French proclaiming scalp bounties. Scalp bounty, think about that. Little city government down here affects an ordinance that says anybody who brings in proof of death of a particular group will be compensated in a particular amount, kind of like a wolf bounty. You've heard of those. This is for Indians. Any Indians. Doesn't matter which Indian. It's not personalized. It's the group want to go away here. So we'll pay you for proof of death in the form of a scalp or bloody red skin. Oh, that's where a red skin comes from. That's right. There's a professional football team by that name. That's clever. That's cute. You just thought it had to do with melanin, didn't you? Wouldn't be anything racist about that, but that's not what it's about, really. Whether the owners of the Washington Redskins know it or not, that's part of the proclamations of the bounties. That if you brought a strip of red, bloody red skin in, you would be paid for it. Oh, yeah, that's kind of like naming your team after Hannibal Lecter. Oh, no, that was Buffalo Bill. Lecter ate your liver with fava beans and a fine Chianti. There's a highly genteel, civilized representative of the civilization here. It was Buffalo Bill that was skinning the women and making the garments. Wouldn't really seem quite so benign while we're commemorating if sports teams were being named in that fashion, that sort of commemoration, which they say is honoring Indians, you see. Let me honor women in the same fashion. Oh, they do have a team named the Buffalo Bills, don't they? Maybe they are. Never looked at it that way. Did you? That would be a little bit of a reach with the Cleveland Indians, with the Washington Redskins, with the Florida State Seminoles, with the University of Illinois Fighting Illini, with the Chicago Blackhawks, with, you want me to keep ticking them off, the Lamar, Colorado High School Savages. You don't have to do much of a reach. You know exactly what you're talking about. Commemorate. Commemorate is to honor. Indians are always being honored in this fashion. But if we were to honor women, Buffalo Bills would refer to the guy who's skinning the women and wearing their skins as garmentage. We could honor Latinos in a similar fashion. How about a sports team for Galveston, Texas? They don't have a professional sports team. Galveston Greasers. Okay? Well, we don't have to regionalize this. You've got a lot of Puerto Ricans and other Latinos as well up in the Northeast. How about the Boston Beaners? Yeah? Wetbacks? Really honoring. Asians? Asians have been discriminated against. Let's honor them. Boy, you can get in some good stuff here. Gooks, Slopes, Nips, Zipperheads. Nobody heard that latter one? You've heard them all. They're all GI parlance, and this is, after all, commemorating the cost and consequence of America's wars. The sense and sensibility really comes out of that. That's what commemoration is. We're infused with it. How do you honor those of the other side who fell in the Indian Wars, or the war, the conquest of the northern half of Mexico, with an acceptable social vernacular right up to the point of publicly naming sports teams in these fashions? Is this kind of demeaning and degrading and dehumanizing language? And through language, we shape sensibility. And to demean, degrade, and dehumanize the other you're going to kill is the essence of how we conduct a war, is it not? How do we understand ourselves and see ourselves is what the upshot of Memorial Day is supposed to be, to commemorate, to reflect, to arrive at an understanding and a communion with those who came to understand it sometimes too late while they're in the process of pulling the trigger. But when you're in the combat zone, it's too late. It's too late. When they point the gun at you, you're going to pull the trigger or you're going to die. It's too late to be reflecting on why. Why you go there. What you do when you are there. What it will mean in terms of the formation of consciousness and values in the society that you're representing, what the impact will be on the others, and what the relationships will end up being as a result of that. All of those are part of the calculus that we should be trying to come to grips with. But we live in a society that increasingly, and you've had some experience of it this week, is dedicated in significant proportions to constraining the range of analysis, consideration of fact, the entirety of the discourse, to a sort of block cheerleading ideological reinforcement of the status quo that occurs unquestioningly in obedience to orders. Instantaneous and unquestioning obedience to orders. It takes a lot of indoctrination and impairment of critical faculty to produce perfectly adequate human beings and put them into a mold where they'll comport themselves in that fashion. It's a monumental effort to not only comport themselves in that fashion, but say and genuinely believe at some level that it is the opposite of what it is. That to be unquestioning and instantaneous in your obedience to order is the essence of freedom. How you penetrate that? How do you penetrate that? That's what our institutions, having to do with education, are supposed to be about, which is why education's of institution. Educational institutions are a principal target of the right today. Yeah, think about it. It's the expungement of critical engagement to where the entire process of what passes for education in the United States, beginning at about age 4 or 5 and carrying on, if you go that far through the PhD, is essentially to be presenting people with sets of questions that they've never had an opportunity to formulate in their own mind and providing them soundbite answers, which you are to memorize and regurgitate on a standardized test so that you can punch your ticket and move on to the next level of indoctrination. Education and indoctrination are different things. And what the issue with me about, or what the issue with the instructors at community college over here are about, or what the education system in Arizona is about, or what the David Project's attacks on Mideast studies, Columbia University are about, or any of about 50 other examples that I could name, is to impose indoctrination, ensure that indoctrination in the name of education supplants the reality of any possibility of education. It's events like this, not just this one, not uniquely, but everywhere. It is events organic to the community that come out to create the barrier that can prevent the consummation of that process of converting institutions which have a worthy social purpose into the opposite of themselves. At that point, and I'm seeing the first hand go up, okay, I've stimulated something. That's a good sign. That, I think, is probably a good place to stop. I've tried to open up some things to stimulate some thought. Let's do a little mud wrestling here. Thank you for listening. Okay, the drill is this. Some stuff being recorded here. For purposes I'm not entirely sure even the people doing the recording are aware of just yet. But in order for this to be coherent to somebody who's not present, when the question's asked, I'm going to repeat the question first, and that's not to make sure that everybody here hears it. You probably will. But whoever ends up listening to this in another medium also knows what the question was. That said, you let off. Fire when ready.
Mr. Ward, Church, I don't disagree with some of what you said. However, I want to pose you a question. While I give thanks to our honorable dead who have fought for the liberty of this country, I want to ask you this question. Do you think that in any of these socialist or communist countries that you can stand up here and speak your speech without going to prison or being tortured to death. Thank God for the United States of America.
Okay. Now, I'm going to repeat your question for the other audience. If you feel that I misrepresented it, jump back up and we'll try it again, okay? We agree?
All right, Ed.
Okay. The questioner or commenter or combination of the two says he agrees with part of what I said. But then the question is whether I think that any of these communistic, socialistic countries, I could stand up and make my speech without going to prison, being killed or tortured. Thank God for the United States of America. That pretty well get it?
Well done.
Thank you. Okay, I got a well done, so that was reasonably accurate. Okay, the answer is, yeah. Yeah, I could. And in fact, I have. The only place...
Saudi Arabia, you've gone to Russia and spoken against the Kremlin. You've gone to socialist and communist countries.
Let him answer
spoken
the
against
question.
Those countries. Sir, I don't believe you.
Let him answer the question.
Have you? Why would I? I think you're
okay. All right. There's a follow-on to that, and then we're going to move on to the next questioner. All right. I have, this is by way of a question, I have gone to Venezuela and made speeches
against that country,
and Saudi Arabia, Russia,
against that country.
But am I missing any countries? I'm aware it's against the country, but... Venezuela. Venezuela 2 years ago, and yes, I did. It's Trotskyite line, and I attack Trotskyism mercilessly. So, I've never been to. I've never been to Saudi Arabia, so I have not spoken against the regime there in Saudi Arabia. But that's a U.S. ally, last I heard. So. I think I've just answered your question. Yeah, you listed some countries. I just gave you one, and I did, in fact, go there and make a speech that was highly critical of the Trotskyist formulation, which is the guiding light, apparently, of the government. At least that's what the diplomats that I've had interaction with in D.C. seem to believe. And they brought Mary Alice Waters from the Socialist Workers Party down to be their liaison from the United States. So it seems fairly clear. So the answer is... Yes. Okay. I never was fired in Venezuela, frankly, but okay, for speaking. Didn't Eugene V. Debs come by through Grand Junction at some point in the earlier part of the 20th century? 1908. And then he ran for president and got about 1 million votes, and then he went in prison for making speeches opposing U.S. involvement in World War I, and said something as he went in, it's a very dangerous enterprise to exercise a right to free speech in a constitutional democracy of this sort. Did something like 5 years. Or Kate Richards O'Hare telling University of Kansas, I believe it was, and that was before Bob Dole was born even, about time World War I. Stands up and says that American women have a destiny greater than to serve as brood sows for the military-industrial complex. That's not, she didn't use military-industrial complex. It's a paraphrase, the brood sow part's a direct quote. She got 5 years for that. So I think going to prison in this country for speechifying is not exactly unheard of. Or rather, longer list of examples I could give, but we have another question here.
Yeah, I heard you say that your experience in Vietnam really began to radicalize you in your life. It was very influential. Can you describe bits of that transformation?
Okay, the question was, I have said that my experience in Vietnam had quite a bit to do with my radicalization. And can I explain some bits and pieces of that? Is that correct? Okay. Yeah, I have said that. And the reason I've said that is because it's true. I mean, I grew up on Audie Murphy just like everybody else. Wasn't raised on a reservation. I was raised in South Central Illinois. That's not exactly a hotbed of radicalism. I volunteered to go to Vietnam. Actually, it would be true if I said I volunteered to Vietnam because I was so desperate to get out of Kansas and I was stationed at Fort Riley, but we don't need to go there either. But I identify and have, since I was a child, identified with the American Indian lineage of my heritage. I don't deny the other. Look at me. What good would it be for me to deny German heritage? I've talked about that, and sometimes as a joke, people say, what's your tribe? I say, Teuton. But I identify as I identify. That's my self-concept, and it has been since my grandma told me stories when I was a little boy. In 1968, I find myself half a world away from where it was I wished to be, being sent out on missions into what was referred to as Indian country. Yeah, and that's what anything outside concertina wire, U.S. base camps, and other positions was referred to. That's the colloquial slang. I identify as I identify, make no secret about it, and so I became chief, of course. And chief, well, got strange notions having to do with racial biology in this country. Indians can smell the enemy. I don't know, I can smell anybody that stinks, but put me in a fairly interesting position. So you got that line of things. And what was happening in Vietnam, the mode of fighting in that war, Vietnam Veterans Against the War, Winter Soldier Tribunal, got to the tip of the iceberg. But I can show you pictures of LERP teams with the heads of those they had killed, scalps, ears, genitalia. George Patton's son was presented the polished skull of one of the kills of his command as a going away present when he went home. I'm not gonna go off too far into that, but it was carnage on a colossal and continuous scale. Not that you're necessarily the one inflicting it at every given moment. It's not like a bad TV movie. It's continuous combat, but you're continuously, you can't have that kind of firepower deployed in a heavily populated locality and not have bodies and pieces of bodies and such around all the time. So there's that aspect to it. There's another aspect, too. There's many layers to it. That's one. That's key. That's visceral. That's gut level. That doesn't ever go away. And if you're part of it and you feel that way about it, the obligation to do something about it so it doesn't come down this way again doesn't go away either. I came back, in a sense, at war with the structural realities that have put me in that position. Stupid 19-year-old self that I was when I went, and I still am, only even more so now because there has been this reinforcement recursively throughout my adult life of warfare fought against dissident populations inside this country, counterinsurgency warfare waged against the American Indian movement in South Dakota in the 1970s. I cut my political teeth in something called the Rainbow Coalition, and I'm not talking about Jesse Jackson. I'm talking about Fred Hampton, who was deputy chair of the Black Panther Party in Chicago, Illinois, was assassinated along with my sometime roommate Mark Clark, Peoria defense captain, in 1969. I can keep chopping these up. That's the reality. So One thing is an extension of the other. The other level of it was, I was told, we were all told, the United States had entered into a solemn treaty under which it had an obligation to come to military assistance of the democratic government of South Vietnam. I was on about that a little while ago, freedom for the Vietnamese. There was no democratic government in South Vietnam. There was no South Vietnam. That was wholly a U.S. creation by virtue of the violation of the 1954 Geneva Accords. The country was to be reunified and the military force was to prevent that from happening. That was a lie, which doesn't necessarily address the content of the treaty, but the content of the CETO treaty, which I actually read. Most troops didn't. I was always a little weird that way. I went down, you could get it. If you actually got into a major base camp, they had a little library thing, you could get it. It was in collections of documents. I read it. There was no obligation for the United States to go to Vietnam, not under the CETO treaty. It didn't oblige the United States to do that any more than it obliged Australia to do it. And the only reason Australia sent any troops at all is because the U.S. coerced them into doing it. They had to hire the Koreans. Those were mercenaries. That wasn't a national commitment on the part of Korea. The United States paid lock, stock, and barrel for the rock divisions that were sent down there. That was a U.S. operation, start to finish, had nothing to do with the treaty. It was not, I was over there fighting for a non-existent treaty obligation. And even then, I was savvy enough to realize that there were as we put it at the time, 371 duly ratified treaties between the federal government of the United States and various American Indian nations right here in this country, and the U.S. was in violation of every one of them. The contradiction there, somehow or another, added to this other, more direct, visceral, emotional response to the reality I encountered. There it is. Now, I understand that Iraq Veterans Against the War is involved in this in some respect.
They endorsed it.
Anybody from that organization? Okay, I won't take personal testimony from that. Gets his name from an organization I'm a life member of. That's Vietnam Veterans Against the War. Okay. Iraq Veterans Against the War takes its name from VVAW, but it's more aligned with Veterans for Peace. That's politics we don't need to really go into much either, but just point of clarification so there's not confusion on the alignments there. Yeah. Clear enough answer? Thank you.
What exactly do you want?
Oh. That one was loud enough that it might have come through without my repeating it, but I will repeat it for the recording device. What exactly do you want? That's a good question. Allows me an opportunity to impersonate a Republican. Law enforcement. Or maybe I should reframe that a little bit. Compliant, no. I ain't get there yet. You got to start somewhere, and this is where I start. Compliance with law. No, I don't mean the goddamn no smoking sign plastered on every flat surface in the United States at this point either. Nor do I mean the traffic regulations or the speed limit. I'm not too awful worried about shoplifting, petty theft. I'm talking about the big laws. How about constitutional compliance with Article 1, Section 10, making a treaty between sovereigns? Article 6 of the U.S. Constitution, it says that a treaty once for all ratified is supreme law of the land. How about the United States getting compliance with its treaty obligations? How about someone show me where you got a non-coerced, non-fraudulent treaty acquisition of the territory we're standing on? And if you can't, then acknowledge the obligation to, how was it George H.W. Bush put it, restore territory that was unlawfully taken, restore legitimate governments that have been usurped and all the rest of that. How about just starting with basic compliance with law and the use of the agencies whose purpose is ostensibly that to enforce that compliance. For real. Rather than, oh, well, that's inconvenient, we'll ignore it. Now let's get about enforcing order upon those whose rights are violated through the violation of the major laws like the treaties. That's what I want. That's where we start. Where it ends up, hey, that goes to the self-determination of the peoples involved, and I'm in no more position to dictate what that determination should be than is the federal government of the United States. That's their choice. Okay? Like I said, a Korean choice for the Koreans, a Vietnamese choice for the Vietnamese, and so on. I don't make choices for other people.